From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in a moment. A moment when our life ends, and we head off into the night, so to speak. That's the title of a new documentary coming to PBS and WXXI-TV this coming Monday night, and it is extraordinary. Into the Night takes an intimate look at life, and more pointedly, at death. The filmmakers chose to focus the film on nine people, telling their stories and hearing their experiences with mortality. One of the nine is University of Rochester astrophysicist Adam Frank. Adam is what he calls an atheist plus, someone who doesn't believe in a traditional God, but doesn't want to hold fast to certainty about death. And Adam has had good reason to think about death. He was very close to his brother, who died in a car accident at the age of 16. All nine portraits in the documentary offer thoughtful, poignant views about death. It can be a difficult subject to consider, but I must say, this is one of the conversations on this program that I'm looking forward to most. Later this hour, we'll talk to Helen Whitney about why she chose to focus on the subject of death for her documentary. But first, astrophysicist Adam Frank, welcome back to Connections.
Great to be back.
This is not the subject I expected to talk to you about, though I guess it sort of lines up. I mean, you think in big terms and big ideas. Death. How did PBS find you? The job that Helen Whitney and the team did is beautiful.
It is beautiful. I think they did a beautiful job with that documentary.
So why are you one of the nine? How did they find you for this?
So Sean Carroll, you know, my friend, who I often disagree with, had written a piece.
Tell the audience who Sean Carroll
is. So Sean Carroll is a physicist, you know, has written a bunch of, you know, very popular books. And Sean is very much a sort of materialist reductionist. You know, he's sort of like, you know, all that exists in the world are atoms and, you know, that's it. And all you are your neurons, which are themselves atoms. And I'm not a reductionist, you know, that's not the way I think about things, even though I'm an atheist. But so he wrote something that says, like, you know, I know there's nothing that happens after death because I've got these equations and there's nothing in there that would say that there's anything after death. And I was just like, whoa, wait a minute. It says, you know, I'm an atheist and everything. But when it comes to death, it sort of seems taking a strident position about anything as a scientist, you know, in this case, you know, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense because until somebody shows up and is like, hi, I was dead and now I'm going to tell you what it was like, you know, there's no data. So I just don't need to take a strident position about, you know, what happens after, you know, what happens after life, or after the, you know, the life ends. So that was really my main position. I was just saying I'm agnostic about this because there's no data about it. And I think that is how, you know, Helen found me.
Helen found you through Sean Carroll?
No, she found me through the post I did on NPR on our blog in response to Sean Carroll.
Gotcha. 13.7 Cosmos and Culture. And so she finds you, she reaches out, and what did she tell you? She said, I'm thinking about death and I'd love to have your thoughts.
Yeah, and I was like, oh boy, I can't wait. No, what happened was is she, you know, told me what her project was, that she was doing this documentary. And you know, it happened to be in New York, you know, just in a couple of weeks, and I went to her house. You know, she invited me over to talk for a while because she was still, I think she was talking to a lot of people and trying to figure out who she'd like to use. And she has this incredible apartment in New York, and, you know, in the Village, where, you know, you take the elevator up and it's the whole, you know, she has the whole, and it's the most beautiful art. And she's just, you could just tell this is a woman who just, you know, really has great sensitivities to the world. You can just tell that by the, you know, the way she lived. And we had this amazing 3-hour conversation where I told her my story. She was asking my story. Actually, we started off just asking. She was asking me about my attitudes about death as a scientist. And then, you know, I told her the story about my brother,
which we'll get to coming up here.
Yeah. Right. And that then led, one thing led to another. And yeah, so then she came out here to Rochester for 3 days. This was 2 years ago. And filmed, you know, we filmed interviews. She also had me, because she's a documentarian, she had me do things sort of, you know, so it was my first chance to act, you know, which was a little weird.
That was 2 years ago?
I think it was 2 years ago. Yeah, it was the summer, maybe a year and a half. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Finally getting ready to broadcast. It's called Into the Night. It'll broadcast nationally on PBS and so, of course, on WXXI-TV, March 26th at 9 p.m. March 26th is a Monday. Monday night, 9 p.m. You got to check it out because, as Adam said, this is clearly someone who is sensitive, open-minded. This isn't just a polemic. This is not just a, you know, closed-minded view of faith or atheism or anything. This is nine different perspectives, people gone through different things.
Some religious, some not.
Exactly.
So it's really the whole range of views about it.
Yeah, and so we're going to talk to Adam and we're going to talk to Helen this hour. But some of the territory we explore with Adam will come directly from some of what he says in I was going to say Light of the Stars. That's the name of your new book, Into the Night. But some of it not. And you got to watch the whole thing because it's about an hour and a half and all nine perspectives are worth absorbing and thinking about. And you describe yourself as an atheist, but you said in this documentary that the lust for certainty is the most damaging thing humanity has. Do you extend that to your friend Sean Carroll?
You know, this is an argument I get into with Sean all the time.
As in, like, you can't know there's nothing, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he would say that because of the equations, you know. I mean, Sean's a very open-minded guy in that view, and we're often going back and forth about this. But I do think that in general, yeah, certainty, especially when it comes to questions like this, is doesn't help, right? And it locks people into a certain kind of rigidity that takes you away from the openness and the beauty of life. You know, that is really, I think, one of the reasons, you know, like, obviously nobody wants to talk about death, right? Because it's not exactly a pleasant subject. But, you know, it used to be that we had a lot of death around us. I mean, people died in your home and you kept them in your home for a few days. It was interesting. Part of this came out from what was talked about in the documentary and then other people I've met through the documentary, is that it's really only in the last 150 years that death has become a purely medical thing, you know, and, you know, nobody dies around you. They're always off in some building and you never see them except maybe in the open casket. And, you know, for most of humanity, there was death around us. It was just seen as part of life, you know. I mean, nobody was, you know, nobody wanted to die. But on the other hand, it wasn't this hidden secret thing that you didn't even have experiences with. And I think that loss, that's really a loss for us because, you know, the point of life is to live it as richly as possible. And if you have certainty and if you block out death and sort of treat it like it doesn't exist and it has to be fought at all possible costs, you're losing the richness of life.
So that certainty extends in different directions. And you did say in the documentary that certainty is the cause of violence in human history.
I think a lot of that is really true. I mean, you know, this idea that we have to be, you know, life at the core, for me, at the core of life is this essential mystery, which is the verb to be. What does it mean to be, right? And then the weirdest thing is, like, I can't stop being until I die, in which I won't be, and then something else happens, and I don't know what it is. And the sort of locked rigidity of trying to respond to that, I think, you know, a lot of the violence in the world comes from people that is fundamental existential fear of the fact that, you know, we seem to cease to be. And so having to come up with rigid ideas of what happens afterwards or what this is all about is, and then demanding it. Because, you know, the people I meet, whether they're religious or not religious, who are the most vehement and the most certain about their answers, I think they're the ones who are the most actually insecure about their answers. Mm-hmm. You know, the people who are deeply religious, who I really respect, are the ones who have that kind of fluidity, who understand that.
Yeah, just as an example that comes to mind immediately. When Terry Schiavo's case was active, you know, when people were watching that very sad situation, largely speaking, the people who clung to the idea that you cannot allow someone to die, you know, the crude terms people have, it's you can't pull the plug, that kind of a thing. Even if someone is in a state of which doctors say there is no coming back to, you know, regular sort of consciousness or cognitive recognition, that you can't allow that person to die, you can't do that. You have to keep them alive with machines as long as you can, even if it's years, when those same people are the people who are arguing that beyond this life is paradise.
Yeah, yeah.
I found some dissonance with that.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's an interesting thing. Again, because I think, you know, what life, you know, what I think what wisdom is really about is a recognition of the uncertainty that, you know, all of our ideas are really just, you know, they're approximations, perhaps at best, you know, approximations, and that the world is so much richer than we can possibly express in our words. And that has to be extended to, you know, our understandings of death as well. That sort of death is the great open question, and to be rigid about it and to be rigid and certain, you know, I think it doesn't, when something is lost, you know, in that. So, you know, people I know who are deeply religious and have, you know, a deep sense of the afterlife, but the ones I really find who are somewhat fluid about it are the ones who display the most wisdom in the face of the stress and, you know, of when people are dying or when, you know, when death needs to be attended to. And if the ones who are most rigid are the ones who actually can't respond when wisdom and compassion are needed.
I know you pretty well. I assume that you feel as I do and that we don't want to condescend to people who are deeply religious.
No, not at all.
That we don't want to condescend to the people who say that, whether it was Terry Schiavo or anyone, you must keep them alive medically with technology as long as you possibly can. So I understand the fear that comes with death and some of the consternation people have about not knowing. I'm just observing that maybe in the human condition is the idea that beyond this is probably nothing, or nothing that we can grab onto an experience. Kind of like the, you know, it's like we're going to go back to 1746, you know. I didn't really have a good sense of what life was like in 1746 because I didn't exist. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But I wonder if in the back of our minds that is there and is part of faith, a construct to deal with that. And the people who don't kind of subscribe to a religious faith are processing it a little more directly in the way that you sort of do, embracing the not knowingness and then contrasting it with the finiteness of a human lifetime versus sort of the almost timelessness of stars.
Well, I think people, you know, people of faith, again, it's sort of what, you know, faith can be a call, you know, for me, the problem is never faith. The problem is literalism of any kind, whether it's faith-based or not faith-based, where you sort of take some script, you know, and you're like, that's it, that those words and nothing else. And that's true for atheists as well with the equations, you know. I think, you know, all of our no words, no equation can corral the abundance of life, the abundance of this thing we call life, this experience of life. There's always something overflowing the cup that explanations or words can't capture. And so, you know, it's like Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, said, you know, people think they want the meaning of life, but what we really want is the experience of life. And so, like I said, you know, many people I know who, you know, have a deep faith-based approach to the world, it's because of their understanding that this is all, there's a, you know, the deep mystery, that when they're called upon, you know, because someone's dying, that they have the most, that's what I see, the most wisdom and the most compassion and the most willingness to deal with the difficult thing. So that's, you know, that's often where I see, like, I'm like, wow, well, that's pretty amazing.
Is there a bit of a bummer, though, that at least in your standpoint as an atheist, the great mystery of what death really is, you think you probably know, or at least you think there's probably nothing, but it is a mystery. Mm-hmm. And if you are right, you don't get to know that you are right.
Yeah, right, right. You know, but I have this kind of like, you know, cosmic, groovy, woo-woo kind of thing that, like, you know, if it's nothing, it's a return to, you know, it's a return to the great ocean of being. Right. I mean, that my molecules, my, you know, the energy that makes me, you know, is a return. But, you know, nothing. I just really what I never have understood, even as a kid after, you know, I lost my brother and I contemplated death, is the idea that why is nothing terrifying? Right. So, like, you know, as I made this point in a blog one time, you know, if I look back to, like, you know, 1890.
Yeah, that's right? Why I said like 1746 or whatever. Yeah.
Right. I'm not like, oh, my God, 1890. I wasn't around. That's terrifying. How could I not be? You know, it's like, oh, yeah, 1890. So why would I be like 2,240? Would I be like, oh, my God, I'm not going to be here? You know, my unbeing then will be equivalent to my unbeing in the future. So if it's truly, if consciousness just falls apart, right, if my consciousness just falls apart and is, you know, upon death, since I am not there to say what a bummer, then how could it possibly be a bummer?
I'm with you on the idea, but Paul Fidalgo, who does a lot of work for organizations that are humanist organizations, atheist organizations, writes a pretty interesting blog. Paul wrote a piece pushing back on this, saying, Adam is right in that in the 1800s, I wasn't around to think, boy, this sucks being dead, you know, or not being alive.
Right.
But now that I'm alive and I see how awesome it is to be alive, I don't want to go back to that because I'm acutely aware as an alive person of how I'd rather be an alive person versus a not alive person.
Well, you know, I think one of the great essences of true religion, you know, true spirituality and really actually true science is like, yeah, well, tough luck. You know, you don't get the world you want. You get this world. So it's like, you know, facing the way things really are, you know, the way things really are and being able to take comfort in that, you know, there's a Buddhist who once said, you know, you want to know what you can have faith in, that this moment is exactly what this moment is. You know, and so, you know, it's, I just don't find that a very convincing or compelling argument because, you know, the fact of the matter is there will be a time when this, you know, I will, you know, my body will fall apart. And so, you know, I just don't, you know, that's going to happen. So I can, if I choose to, I can be upset or I can acknowledge the reality of that.
Talking to Adam Frank, a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester, the author of Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth, that is forthcoming this year. And he is featured in the Into the Night broadcast on PBS. It's a documentary about life and death, featuring nine perspectives, nine men and women changed by their encounters with mortality in various ways. And you can watch Into the Night coming up on WXXI-TV, March 26th, Monday night, 9 p.m. It's beautiful. Now, your brother was 7 years older than you, and you said in the documentary he was your protector.
Yeah, I grew up in northern Jersey, you know, the industrial wastelands of Jersey. And, you know, I grew up in a pretty hard town. It was a, you know, working class Irish and Italian Catholic neighborhood. And I was like the only Jewish guy in the entire I was the Jewish population of Belleville, New Jersey. And lots of really great people. But also there was a lot of, you know, a lot of prejudice, anti-Semitism back in the day. And also my mom, my parents were divorced, which nobody was in those days. And my stepdad was African-American. He was the first state legislator, African-American state legislator in Jersey, and a civil rights leader, really courageous civil rights leader. So, like, there were a lot of reasons why things were hard, you know. And my parents were, they were off doing their civil rights stuff and saving the world. And, like, you know, my sister and I were kind of left to our own devices. And my brother, who was a big guy, was my protector. I was often getting, you know, getting beaten up, you know, doing my best, you know, to fight back. But, you know, So when he died, when I was nine, that was pretty much, there was nobody else left who was kind of paying attention. And yeah, so that was a loss. There was a lot of ways that was a loss. And, you know, he was the one who introduced me to baseball, you know, the 69 Mets, you know, he took me to the games, you know, so there was a lot of things that he was just essential for me.
Adam's brother's name was David. Again, Adam was nine and David was 16.
Yeah.
A drunk driver?
Drunk driver came along. We were at me and my sister and my brother went to the summer camp, YMCA, amazing YMCA day camp. And it was the last day of day camp, you know, and my brother was a counselor. So the counselors were all.
What was the place called, by the way?
Dawson, Camp Henry H. Dawson.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't ask that to tee that up because I ask because a good friend of mine is a director of a New Jersey camp.
Oh,
but it's not
Henry H. Dawson.
It's not Dawson.
There you go.
Okay.
I can sing camp songs. I'll get all teary eyed.
You don't
want me to go down.
No,
there.
No.
And so the counselors were all going off for, you know, the end of summer weekend. And yeah, and so there were four, you know, teenagers in the car. And you know, it was not their fault. It was a drunk driver coming along on the wrong side of the road, killed three of them and disfigured the other one.
Now, there's a note in the film, and I was asking Adam before the program began, is that a real note? It's a note, a handwritten note on a lined piece of paper. And the note says the following. Love can be good, but it can also be bad. I lost my brother David today. It hurts. You were 9 years old. You wrote that day?
Yeah, it was yeah.
And that's the actual note?
That's the actual note, yeah. Yeah, and I remember writing it. You know, I mean, it's hard to, you know, to go back to those memories. Obviously, you know, the death of a sibling at that age, you know, that was the turning point in my life in so many ways. You know, there's before and afterwards. And yeah, you know, I mean, you know, the thing is when you're 9 years old and something like that happens, it's really hard to know what's going on, right? You know, the idea that, like, what do you mean he's not coming back? You know, I mean, just the and that's what really affected me and, you know, led me into a lot of the directions, you know, like I said, that shaped my life and my approaches to life, both intellectually and more than, you know, emotionally. It's just like, yeah, that, wow, your contract can be canceled at any moment. Like, that was really a shock. Like, oh, you mean anybody can die and disappear? So, yeah, that was the response there was that sort of like really fundamental, you know, response of a 9 year old of being like, wow, you know, this is terrible.
Now, I want to ask you why you think you turned in the direction you did to finding the comfort that you find in the stars. Because when there is a death that is that jolting to anybody, to kids some degree, but certainly to adults, but sometimes as kids become adults, faith becomes a real outlet. And I say that with real appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
For the value,
yeah.
For the hope, for the perspective, for the grounding that faith can provide. And that was not the case for you. You didn't as a 9-year-old turn to faith, and you didn't become an adult who used faith to help you cope with David's death. Why do you think that is?
I had been turned on to science and the stars early on. When I was 5 years old, my dad had pulp science fiction, magazines, in his library. And even at five, I remember holding one of those with those covers, where they had some guy bouncing on the moon, those looking like the Michelin tire man. And already then, those landscapes of the stars, of the planets, long before anybody had ever visited one, just, it was gripping. It was gripping to me. And more than that, I had already the idea of science offering this perspective on the world that went deeper, went below the surface. I tell the story in the documentary of, this is before my brother died, of, there was a thunderstorm going on, big booming thunderstorm.
I love this story.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and this was.
How old were you?
I must have been probably seven.
Okay.
I was pretty young. So we're hanging out, me and my dad, and this huge thunderstorm with lightning, and I'm like terrified. And he's like, whoa, wait a minute. Let me tell you what thunder is. And he goes to this, my dad was a great writer and great, could really explain things well. And he had this great explanation of thunder as being, there's these electrons. You're basically getting electricity booming through or shooting through the atmosphere. It superheats the air, and then the air expands really fast, and that's the thunder, And it was just like a revelation. It's like, oh, then I don't need to be afraid of it. Literally, I'm terrified. And then he offers this beautiful explanation that's really cool. And I'm like, no, I guess I don't need to be afraid of it. And that, when my brother died, I already had an inclination towards the stars and science, in a weirdly spiritual way, right? And I remember, afterwards for months turning, I had these big picture books of astronomy pictures of, pictures of stars, star fields and gas clouds, nebula where stars are being born. And just looking at those, just literally falling into them. And that the majesty, the magnitude of the universe, that I knew how far away stars were, learning to understand how big a light year was. And I just found it so comforting. The universe is so big. And I would look at those stars and I would just focus on one. There's 38 stars, a thousand stars in the picture. And I would just look at one of them and ask myself, what's going on there? Right now, something's going on there. That's a place, And that just gave me such enormous comfort because, my story is just I'm part of the universe, but, there's lots of stories being written. And so my pain is real, but it has to be weighed against, all the other stories that are happening in the universe.
All right. So I love the lightning story because it is a beautiful illustration of how we can fear what we don't understand. And one of my favorite podcasts, NPR's Invisibilia, did an episode on fear in which they tried to cure one of the co-hosts' fear of snakes. Saying, maybe you fear snakes because you just don't understand them.
Right.
How do they move? And they slowed it down. They talked to these scientists like, how are snakes able to move this way and that? Snakes are very helter-skelter. They're very unpredictable. But how, And they talk about the mechanism of how snakes move, and it did not work. She said, I get it now, but it still freaked me out.
I don't want snakes around.
But that was just one sort of mini experiment. It didn't invalidate the idea that in many cases, with more understanding, we reduce fear. That's how we feel about people who do not look like us.
Right.
People from different racial backgrounds,
right,
and different income backgrounds and different places. It applies to so many things. So the more we understand of something, the less we fear it, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But, this is where I say the but, you're sitting here with an immense amount of comfort about death, but that's the one thing you don't understand.
Well, it's so right. So here it's not, I don't have an understanding of it, but I do have what science, and I want to be clear, I'm an atheist, but I clearly have, and my first book was about sort of, I clearly believe in sacredness, that there's a way in which I'm like an atheist plus, in the sense that, I have a sense, and that's why I've been, my whole life I've been working on this, that, the world is illuminated in ways that are, very, very powerful. And that it's, that there is mystery. It's, in the end, it's not about explaining. Science by itself doesn't explain everything, because in the end, it's not about explanations. Being human is, explanations are just one of the things we do. There's art and there's music and all these other things combine to make this experience of the world so rich. So, Yeah, you know, obviously death, it's not like I'm you know, I have an explanation for what's going to happen afterwards, but it's this understanding of how big and vast and beautiful and variegated and, you know, and just incredible the universe is. The snakes, like, oh my God, how did they move? And, you know, evolution had to do this. That just makes me, there's nothing to be afraid of. That's how my view is. There's nothing happening in this world to be afraid of. That, you know, this is, the world moves in its way. You know, and we are part of that. We are part of that story, but no part of it is, you know, I mean, I don't want to get eaten by a bear. I'm really terrified of bears when I go into the woods and I do a lot of hiking. But, you know, being eaten by a bear, not being eaten by a bear, you know, dying in your bed, not being dying, you know, this all, they're just all part of these stories. And so I may have, you know, as I said to Helen in the documentary, like, you know, this perspective doesn't inoculate me from fear. Like if I have a disease or something, I'm going to go through all the things that, you know, people go through when you're, but it also, it puts that fear and that, you know, and the places I have fear, instead of being in a closet, you know, with the fear, I'm in an open field full of hundreds of thousands of stars.
We're going to talk to Helen coming up here, who is behind this remarkable documentary, Into the Night. But before we wrap with Adam Frank, astrophysicist from the University of Rochester, who is one of nine featured in this documentary, I want to talk about the contrast that you throw on human life and the life of stars. Because when you think about David's life, David only got 16 years. Mm-hmm. And the morning that he woke up on his last morning, he didn't know that that was,
right.
That was it. And most of us, well, I would probably guess most of us, don't know that the last day is the last day.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something sort of unpoetic about that. I don't know if it's inpoetic, unpoetic, unfair about that to me, because this is where I want to push back a little bit here too. In the documentary, you say, you think about stars, and stars have a lifespan, but it is almost timeless in terms of our own understanding. I mean, it's just, it could be millions of, right, billions of years. Whereas we get, one of us may get 16 years, one of us may get 76 years, one of us may get 98 years, one of us may get, you know, 24 years. We don't know, but compared to the timelessness of the stars, you know, we're all sort of just a little blip, and,
yeah,
and we've got something beautiful in front of us, and let's sort of appreciate that for now. But given how short the human lifespan is, and I don't mean to get maudlin or sort of overly sentimental, but don't you think David got a raw deal there? Because it's already short. If he had 80 years, that's not a lot. He had 16, that's not fair.
Yeah. No, definitely he got a raw deal. I mean, you know, I got a raw deal. I would have, God, what would my life have been like if I could have had my brother for the rest,
yeah,
of my life?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it would have been, yeah, who knows, you know, the direction. So, you know, I don't, absolutely, you know, it depends on what you're measuring it against, you know, in the measuring against the human values, including my, measured against my love for David and my mom's love for David and what we would have wanted to have happen. Absolutely. But again, you know, measure when you pull back, you know, when you pull back to see your own story set against the stars, which is true, is the true story. It's all about our frame. You know, how do we frame our lives? Just like every day, I could spend today being really pissed off about what that guy did to me yesterday. You know, some guy who, like, you know, beeped at me when I was, you know, I didn't move fast enough at the red light. You know, or I could be, as you know, so I'm a great believer, you know, I've been doing Zen practice for a long time, in this moment, to try and just stay with this moment. What is happening with this moment? Because this moment really, on some level, is all there is. So it's all about the frame. If I can keep that frame, then, you know, I can have both the David's raw deal and the beauty that I had him at all and the effect he had on me. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe who knows? This is always my thing, especially when I talk to hardcore, you know, atheists. Who knows how the world is woven together, how these threads are woven together? It's so intricate that, you know, I just don't think we can say really how things really play out. And that's the mystery. That's the central mystery.
So let me close with this. I was thinking about Adam's point about how we have this desire to find something, anything that doesn't break down over time. And I thought about that while I was watching, of all things, Tiger Woods. Let me explain. So 18 years ago, Tiger Woods was 24 years old, and he was one of the greatest dominant athletes in any sport ever. You know, he was just destroying the golf world, and people watched him in huge numbers. They didn't necessarily love him because he's hard to get to know. He's kind of put up a wall, but they revered him. Well, now he's 42. He hasn't won in years. He's had all these personal struggles. He has failed badly in the public eye. He's kind of come off his pedestal. and he's trying to come back now. And this weekend, he's won off the lead in some nothing PGA Tour event. And the crowds are like the biggest crowds of the year for any event. And the roars are the roars for a beloved figure, not for somebody who's revered, but now for someone who's loved. And I'm trying to figure out why. Tiger Woods is still the same guy. Why is it? And I thought, I get it now. People want to think that they can live forever. They want to believe that Tiger is still the same guy. I remember when I was 25 watching him, and now he's... And all these think pieces, Tiger Woods is back. Yeah. Like he's going to win every week now. Right. He's not. He's 42. He's going to win one or two or three more times, but that's it. Yeah. And we're going to revel in that. But people want to feel like they can recapture or that they're going to live forever. That guy will be as good as he was when I was a kid, and this show will be as... That's why we bring back TV shows
from
our past.
Want to have that experience again of Lost in Space.
Yeah, we're going to bring back Roseanne and Seinfeld and Will and Grace and Lost in Space and everything, and Dynasty, everything.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to age.
Yeah. And no, that's true, yeah.
Why is it that you think we struggle and we are desperate to find anything that doesn't really break down, and then for those who are in that mindset, wouldn't you tell them... You want to find something, you might as well look at the stars. That's the one thing.
Well, even ironically, the stars age, right? Stars do die.
Don't bring me down now, man.
Sorry, man.
I'm rolling.
I'm bumming you out, man. I got a harsher buzz. You know, I'm 55 now, and I'm noticing, you know, there's all, like, I just got pains that show up and then they disappear. And I think what it's really shocking to age, you know? It's really, but, you know, again, I think so much, this is where true science and true religion and spirituality are helpful. It's where you look at what's happening. You don't ignore it. You don't paper it over. You know, you look and you accept it, right? Because the world is bigger than you. You know, there's more going on than you and your story. So this aging... You know, I forgot who it was. The movie star said, "You know, getting old is not for sissies." Yeah, it's not, and you got to face it, and you got to face what's happening, and you can try and plaster it over, but the real courage, you know, is in to actually embody it. And I'm trying to figure out how to do that myself with my knees and whatnot. But you know, that's my perspective: is that you are going to age. Everything ages, and let's really see what that means. Be curious about it.
It is a wonderful documentary, and I've really enjoyed your story. You opened up in ways I didn't know, a lot of things I didn't know about you. So thanks for doing that for PBS and for doing us here today. You're going to hear from Helen coming up here about her documentary. That's Adam Frank. More connections coming up.
Cryonics is a safety belt. You could call it true life insurance. It's the last and final step. I want to make it very clear. Nobody wants to be cryopreserved. I don't want to be one of these tanks, but it may be necessary. It's the second worst thing that can happen to you, right? The idea of sitting in a tank of liquid nitrogen, unable to control my destiny, it's not appealing to me at all. But then I think, well, what's the alternative? Well, I guess I could just die and be gone forever and have no more life, no more relationships, no more love, no more experiences, no more learning. That doesn't sound like a very good alternative. From a very early age, the limitations of human beings just seemed to be frustrating to me, and I was looking for ways beyond that. And one very obvious one is aging and death. I mean, that's the ultimate limitation. It doesn't matter how smart you are, whether you can fly, or whatever else you can do, turn invisible, levitate. None of that matters if you're going to die at some point. It's all going to come to an end. I realized if we're going to do something about it, it would have to be through science and technology. That's the only way to overcome aging and death. Cryonics is essentially an extension of emergency medicine. Think back 50 years or so. Somebody just collapsed and you check for their pulse. They had no pulse, no breathing. They're dead, and that was it. Today, that's not true. We'll pants on them and do defibrillation and CPR and all kinds of things. And in many cases, they come back to life. So you have to ask yourself, were they actually dead 50 years ago? Well, not really. We call them dead because we couldn't do anything about it. So what we're saying is, when today's medicine has reached its limits, let us take over, freezing you in a state, not literally freezing, but we're stopping all molecular motion and then taking you to a time in the future when there's more advanced medical capabilities that may be capable of repairing and reviving the person into a fresh, healthy, rejuvenated body.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to bring in the director of Into the Night. Helen Whitney is on the line with us now. It's great to have you, Helen. Thanks for taking the time. How are you?
I am fine. I'm in San Francisco. What could be bad?
Yes, indeed. We just had a wonderful conversation with Adam Frank about a number of things, but of course, centrally about death. And I asked him how he was contacted for this documentary. I want to ask you, as the person who conceptualized this, What brought the subject of life and really death to mind for you for this kind of a film, Helen?
Well, you know, I am used to taking on challenging subjects, so this is not a first, but it is the most challenging subject I have ever taken on in the 40-odd years I've been making films. And I'm really the sort of the most obvious, honest answer to your question is that I'm a baby boomer. I'm of that period of time when these questions are of mortality and awakening to mortality and how much time you have left are pressing in on me. A number of friends who've died or are sick right now, and it seemed like a very good time, and also to make this film, and to add that, you know, a lot of my films have been circling around these big existential questions, whether it's belief or unbelief in the 9/11 film, the PBS special, or The Mormons, which is about radical belief, among other things, or forgiveness. So it just seemed like a very good time, you know, really in a sense, to come out of the closet and ask the questions that I think we all would like to ask, but we're shy about asking them. We turn away in fear, which is, how do we live with death in our eye? And as a documentary producer, you're really allowed to ask a lot of questions and to hear some extraordinary answers.
You certainly got some extraordinary answers. And one of the things I appreciated most about this film is that it brought this thoughtful lens that didn't just choose one particular angle. It gave us a lot to think about from a lot of different directions. And in the conversation we just had with Adam Frank, he is not in the camp that rages against death, that, you know, sort of fights to the end. He has a very sort of zen, and I'm probably misusing the word zen, but probably a very kind of comforted approach to death, whereas some of the others you talk to struggle with this concept of accepting it and want to push until the very end. And I wonder where you sort of fall in on that spectrum.
Well, I think for a lot of people, including Adam. I mean, as he said in the film, he said, you know, when the doctor comes through with a bad diagnosis, everything that I might be saying to you about finding my narrative of solace in the stars, which he really does, he said, it might just fly away.
Yes.
And it might just fly away. And I think that many of us touch on a lot of the feelings in that Dylan Thomas poem, Do Not Go Gentle Into the Night. There are times when I certainly feel, you know, acceptance, gratitude. I've had a fabulous life. And there are other times when I feel, oh, it's so precious. It's so precious and it's all flying away. And I don't agree with that poem, death is the mother of all beauty. I think, no, you know, it may be the mother of all beauty, but it makes me want to hang on all the more. And I don't have the narrative of comfort that the two people in the who have the faith narrative in the film have, of the woman who really went into death with total equanimity because of her near-death experience, and the Black Baptist, that amazing man who lost both of his children, who lost his faith and then came back.
I had no clue. I thought he was just having another crisis. I didn't know he was getting ready to leave me. I couldn't wrap my mind. I could not wrap my mind around the fact that my Paul I could not believe that the God that I preached about so and talked about so and at a time when I needed him to me. He left me to bear this by myself. I don't talk about it too much, but it interrupted my relationship with God. Death of my son interfered with the way I felt about God. Paul died at 26, Solomon died at 33. It has really taken an unbelievable toll on us as faith believers.
You have a faith narrative, as the novelist said in the film. It's a kind of armor, even though it has chinks in it. It's a narrative of solace. But most of the people in the film have had those moments when, if they're not raging, they'd rather not, and including Adam. But you're right. He really has quite an extraordinary attitude of curiosity, and even, yeah, really curiosity about what's next. And he's unlike a lot of atheists, which is why I was drawn to him. He's almost a romantic atheist. He's open to the mystery. He's a scientist who says, look, I think this is all there is, but how do I know? It's not verifiable. No one's come back. And so he's a poet as well. And he looks at death as this, what did he say in the film? This, our central mystery. It's the first, our first and last question, why? So I was very drawn to him. And even though I don't share his equanimity, I admire it. I mean, I don't know how you feel, but he looks up in the stars and he says, I feel comforted by the distances. And I look at those stars and I think, boy, pretty far away.
I look at them and I think,
I'm so small and he's so big.
Indeed, I look
at
those. I think I appreciate the beauty, and actually, I just listening to Adam, I want to be more like him, because
when I
look at the stars, I think I am so small, I am insignificant,
yes.
I am nothing.
You know? I know what he said in the film. He said, "I don't understand those people who have this existential terror, feeling I'm so small and they're so big." And I think, well, your director's one of them.
Now, Helen, I want to tell you that in the weeks to come on this program, your film has inspired me to host a series of conversations that your film made me think of my father, who is also a boomer. And my dad, in his mid-70s, has been forced into retirement in terms of the job that he's worked for 40 years had a forced retirement. And so he didn't want to retire. My dad is not the kind of guy who could wake up one day and say, well, I got nothing to do, it's great. You know, he wants to have something to do. So on Tuesdays now, my father goes to the NICU and he holds babies and he helps doctors. And he's learning foreign language and he's picking up other work because he just can't imagine it. And he and I were talking after I watched your film. I was back in Cleveland, where he lives recently, just a few days ago, and I asked him more about that, and I said, you really just can't wake up and appreciate all that you've done and have the day in front of you to read a book, to take a walk. And he said, Ev, I'm not necessarily proud of this, but the fact is there is some ego involved and the fear of not being relevant anymore. I thought that was profoundly powerful. And I said, I said, Dad, I'm going to host a series of conversations about this, because I think that is probably natural, but I also think that has something to do with the way my generation and maybe all subsequent generations tend to exclude the voices of people who get older. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Oh, I think that's very true, is that, you know, our fears, which are appropriate and honest and genuine about diminishment and all those quotes about, you know, getting old is not for sissies. This is all true. We're all afraid of pain and diminishment of our physical abilities, but we're also afraid of just feeling invisible. and women as well. We have the added insult of, you know, after 50, most women say, well, we're not even seen. But that sense of having a place in the world and being defined by what we do is really, you know, it's very present. And there are some people who are able to say, I'm just going, you know, I've been living in my head and through the definition of what I've been accomplishing at work, and I'm just going to live in the moment and get up and enjoy my cup of coffee, and I'm going to stroll down and spend time just playing with my grandchildren. And it's a kind of letting go of those definitions that we accept and impose on others. And age really accentuates it. I understand what your father is saying. And, you know, at a certain point, I'm going to be stop making films. And I hope that I will be able to really be more in the moment, more mindful of all that's around me.
Yeah.
It's a good point. And I love the idea of you starting these conversations, which is precisely what I want this film to do. I mean, this is really the mission of the film, is to create this safe, smart place where people can talk about their hopes and fears around this big mystery and share their narratives of solace. You know, God, Adam would be so inspiring in that group, and he would be able to say with laughter, look, it only works 80% of the time, but that's a large part of my day. 80%. It's no small thing.
Well, Helen, I've just got a few minutes left with Helen Whitney, the director and the mind behind the remarkable documentary coming our way Monday night, March 26th on PBS and WXXI-TV. It's called Into the Night. And I want to close our conversation by asking you to just maybe share one or two of the other thoughts or stories that your filmmaking for this documentary uncovered that really have stayed with you that you think our viewers are going to appreciate hearing and seeing on Monday the 26th.
Well, dying patient's dream was shared with me. She died the next morning, and it opens the film, and it's meant so much to me. She said, she died the next morning. She said, I see in front of me, and it opens the film. I imagine myself alone on a boat. It's dark. Oh, and the other lights of boats are all around me, and I can't see them, and I can't talk to them, but I know that they are up at night with me, wondering and thinking about these same questions, and what comfort that is. And I can tell you, after three years and more of having just riveting conversations with people who've been shocked into mortality, hearing their struggles as they get their narratives together or don't get their narratives together, and sharing their hopes and fears, I think you just feel less alone. It may be the most alone thing that we'll ever do, dying, but it's immensely comforting to know that we're not doing it alone. There's a solidarity, a sense of we're in this together.
Lastly, Helen, I wonder if you think that the conversations you have helped start and continue with this documentary are maybe unique is the wrong word, because death has always been a part of life, and death has always been something that, you know, human beings know more than the animal kingdom. We get the cognition to know that it's coming eventually.
Right.
But we are living longer as a species than ever because of medical technology, and so we have more time toward the end to contemplate. And I wonder how that has impacted the way we look at death. If that has, in your view, that extension, has that given us more mental health, or has that made it more difficult to sort of understand what is coming our way?
I think for whatever reasons, we're in the middle of a kind of seismic shift. Youngsters are talking about it. There are death cafes and death salons when the millennials are getting together to talk about dying and about, you know, our estrangement from the body. Baby boomers are talking about it. Look at the tsunami of spiritual memoirs. I'm not exactly sure what's behind, and this new openness. And I'm not sure it's either the extension of life. It may well be. I think the internet has something to do with it. We're feeling more connected and get some of these ideas out there, but it is palpable. And I think this film is unusual, there are plenty of spiritual memoirs out there, but on film, we usually cover, which is so important, but it's not what this film is covering, which is the healthcare system and hospice and all those, and choice, all those important subjects. But this is the interior life. What is your story? What is your attitude? How do you think about this? And I think those conversations are really coming up now. There is a new openness, and I can see it even in the groups in which I go to cocktail parties, and I see people, yes, they turn away in fear, but they also lean in at a kind of rapt readiness to have the conversation.
Helen Whitney, your work has already illuminated other subjects in ways that have been profound, and this film just joins that body of work that you have produced. And we're so thrilled to talk to you. We look forward to seeing Into the Night Monday, the 26th, Monday night on WXXI-TV and PBS. Thank you. Congratulations on another great piece of work here, and we really appreciate the insight.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This was a delight.
And that is another edition of Connections, remarkable stuff, thinking about life and death today. Our thanks to Adam Frank, astrophysicist from the University of Rochester. And of course, you just heard the director and the creator of the documentary, Helen Whitney, there. Looking forward to Monday night on WXXI-TV. Our thanks to all of the technical staff right here at Connections and producer Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon. And we're, of course, right back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.